Well, hello and welcome to the 8th Tim Masso podcast. Thanks so much for joining us. And I do mean us because today, for the first time, we have a guest and a good friend on the show, Josh Thanos, lead watch buyer at GovBird and Watchbox, and a good friend from back in the Watch You Want days. Josh, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Tim. I appreciate you having me on as your first guest. I didn't realize. It's a lot of pressure now.
It's been so low up to this point, so don't worry. I set a low bar.
Yeah, right.
So I got to ask you a question because you're one of the traders who comes to the fore of my mind when I think of collectors. Not every trader is a collector. You're both. How has your collecting taste changed, and what are you collecting now?
Oh, wow. So, it's changed dramatically. I mean, back from the Watch You Want days, and I really wasn't even a watch guy when I started here, but I'm the kind of person who dives in with both feet. So I think the first watch I bought back in those old days, the first Swiss watch I might have bought, I don't know if you can call it that, was like a Stoa.
Okay.
That was my first little dipping my toe in. And after that, I started picking up steam. So I started buying some kind of lower end Swiss watches like that. I picked up an Oris. If you remember, I had the Oris Aquis that I loved. What else did I have? Somehow I got myself a 7 Friday, which was not a Swiss watch.
Maybe part of it.
Yeah.
But the idea.
The idea was Swiss. Yeah, exactly. But I got my hands on that. I don't think I paid for that watch. Fine, and I think I ended up giving it as a gift to somebody. But my first kind of real substantial purchase was the Pan 380, the Radiomir, which I still have that watch. It actually left my collection for a slight time. A buddy of mine wanted to buy it, so I sold it to him, and I told him, "Listen, when you're ready to, when you don't want it anymore, sell it back to me, or I'll pay what you paid for it." I think I sold it to him for $3 and bought it back for $3, so I loaned it to him basically. So that was my first real purchase. I was probably like 2015, so almost like 6 years ago now. And since then, I ended up getting into like Omega Speedmaster or Seamaster, Breitling Aerospace. So again, like lower end watches below $5,000. I started buying a lot of those types of watches. And then 2019, I got the courage. I don't want to say balls, but courage. To start spending a few more bucks on watches, and that's really where things changed for me. I started buying like crazy watches, that in my opinion, crazy watches. So bought a few Rolexes, traded those, realized how easy it was to get in and out of them.
Like, give us an example of a Rolex you owned.
I've owned all like the hot models for the most part. The
Platinum Dial Yachtmaster too.
Okay, that so that actually that was my very first Rolex. You're right about that. So that was 2018 now. So you remember more than I do, man, because I moved so quickly through my watches. So Platinum Dial Yachtmaster 2, so it was the 16622 with the old style bracelet and clasp. That was my very first Rolex. I bought that here with Watchbox. I worked out a deal with Mike Manjos, and I had that watch for probably a year. And then I ended up trading that watch in for a watch for my wife, actually. Are we doing good? Okay.
Yeah,
so,
doing good.
All right. So that's right. So that was my first watch. Then I traded that in towards a Cartier for my wife. And so after that, I've had the 116610 Submariner. I've had that watch a few times. I've had some of the GMTs, the Pepsi and the Batman for short periods of time each time. I just, if I spend more than $10,000 on a watch and I don't immediately love it, I feel like it's like, you know,
do you ever think of maybe doing that in the reverse order, loving it and then spending $10,000?
Yeah, no, that's not my style. Like, you know, but so, well, this is something that I actually discussed on an episode of After Hours. But the problem with me is that I'm compulsive, right? Or I'm impulsive and compulsive, probably. But luckily, since I know I work in this industry, I know how much I should be paying for these things. So I'll buy them. And the price is not really the concern because I know what it's worth, right? So if I was outside, I'd have to do my due diligence and like I'd be very nervous about spending and making sure that I'm getting the right price. But because I'm in this industry, when I buy a watch, I know that, all right, well, at least I should be able to get out of it for a day. So I'm not too concerned with pulling the trigger. But if I have the watch and I've spent more than $10,000 on it and I don't fall in love with it within like 7 days, it's like hot lava. I got to get it out of it. I got to get out of it.
Okay.
So that happened to me a few times with the Batman, the Jubilee Batman. I had the Oyster Batman. I had that. I bought one before it was discontinued. I had a hunch it was going to be discontinued. So then I traded out of that, and there was a little bit of a profit there, which was nice. Most of my watches, I usually either break even or lose money. So that kind of started my journey of kind of collecting a little bit higher end watches. And I've collected some Panerai since, but so if we're sticking on Rolex, I've had the most expensive Rolex I've had was a rose gold Daytona.
Okay. Which, cool bracelet?
Yeah.
Oh.
I've got that the summer of 2019. I bought that watch. I got a good deal on it. I bought it for right around 20. And at that time, they were trading for between 20 and 25 is kind of where. So I found on a forum, I found a guy who was willing to sell and we made a deal. And so I got that watch. I had it for a few months. And then I love that watch. I probably would still have it, but the other thing with me is I have ADD. So I start looking at other watches and I think, oh, I got $20,000 tied up in this. I could have $10,000 and a really nice watch. So I ended up trading that down into a Panerai. And so I think I traded that. I'm trying to remember that trade.
Now, you're talking about crazy watches now. Rolex was the gateway to that. Were these complicated Panerai or?
So the most complicated Panerai is one that I still own. It's a PAM 233. It's my favorite watch. I'll never sell it now. I've realized that this is a watch that now since I bought it, the first day I bought it, I loved it. And I was wearing it last night talking to my wife about how much I love the watch. So, and I've had this watch for 2 years now. So that's the longest standing watch besides some of the, I have some Seamasters and things like that, that are on the lower end. But, so in terms of Panerai, I've had a lot of Panerais, traded those, and it's same thing. I usually lose money on those when I trade out of them, but a few $100 here or there.
Now, are you the type to just private sale everything? Because I think folks assume that because you work for a dealer, you must buy and sell everything through the dealer.
Yeah, not always. I kind of like the eBay thing, right? I mean, again, so because I'm in the unique position of I know more about a lot of these watches than most people, right? Because it's what I do for a living. So I'm less concerned about getting scammed and whatnot. I know how to protect myself. So eBay, I do a lot of eBay trading, some on the forums, and I like doing that for two reasons. Number one, the inventory for the company, right? They buy that to make a profit. So if I were to ask them to sell me something at a cost or something, it would be kind of counterproductive, not counterproductive. It wouldn't be in the essence or the idea of what the company's here for. We're buying watches not for pleasure, but to sell, right? Yeah. For other people to enjoy. So there's, for whatever reason, I just feel weird about buying watches. And I do buy watches from the company. I have in the past. I probably will in the future. But the other thing is that, a lot of my customers, they do go the route buying or selling on eBay or on the forums. And a lot of times you can get a few more bucks that way, but there's also some pitfalls. So for me, putting myself in a position of somebody like that and buying and selling on eBay and on the forums and things like that, outside of what we do, right?
Instead of buying, I think that probably makes you a lot like many committed collectors who, take the all of the above approach to buying and selling watches. It's really the best opportunity at the moment.
Yes. So one thing that it does is it gives me a unique perspective, right? So, if when I started out, if somebody told me, I can sell it on the forums or I can sell it on eBay, while I knew that there was some downsides of doing that because people told me, I never really experienced those. So now I have a true experience. So if somebody is saying, I've never sold on the forum, but I know I can get a few more bucks. And I say, listen, man, you can absolutely try it. You want to try to protect yourself, but there are downsides and these are them. And I know them because I've dealt with this before.
Yeah.
So it gives me a higher level of integrity, I think, because I'm not just talking about somebody else's experience, I'm talking about my own.
I find a lot of times the more specialized the watch, the better the idea of, going with the dealer. Like, for example, we've sold Grand Sonnerie. We have that Audemars Piguet. We just saw the Tradition Tourbillon Minute Repeater Chronograph. It's nice sometimes to have a warranty behind a thing like that, especially when the company is willing to say, if it needs work, it's going back to AP, as opposed to a guy on eBay saying, hey, yo, watch is authentic, but you're on your own, sold as is.
Right.
I think the more specialized and exotic the watch, the more it helps to have, the safety cushion of the dealer. And I think even for us working at the dealer, there's a tremendous peace of mind that comes with buying the really exotic stuff through those channels. Whereas, Panerai, Rolex, Breitling, it's more of a general enthusiast scene.
Well, so the other thing is this, right? So if one of my customers buys a watch from me that he's never tried on, which is kind of how most of my customers buy now, and especially in 2020, it's hard to get a watch on your wrist before you pull the trigger. They have return policies, that are, you know, it's not a fight, right? It's not like...
FYI, guys, if you're listening to this out in cyberspace, anyone who asks you to buy a watch sight unseen should give you a no questions asked right of return.
Yeah. Yeah. But, well, so I have bought watches from eBay that are you know, final sale, no returns.
I have not. I've never taken that step.
I mean, I have, but you know, I just know that if I can't return the watch, I'm going to have to try to move it out to another. So if I get the watch on, I just hate it. And that's the thing. So not being able to try the watch on is a big issue. So if you buy from somebody like us, where there's, you know, 7 days, no question. And if somebody gets the watch and they just don't love it, like, it doesn't even have to be delivered in some, you know, it doesn't have to be messed up or broken. They just don't love the watch. They give me a call, send them a shipping label, they send it back, we return the money. There's no back and forth. There's no question whether or not we're going to take it back or anything like that. So there's the peace of mind. And then also the time that goes into it, right? So like, if you're selling something on eBay, I'm sure if anybody's ever done it before, you know, you're going to get a list of lowball offers.
Yeah.
You're going to get somebody who's going to ask you 50 questions about the watch and then also never make an offer. You're going to get people who will send you like weird emails, then make an offer that's acceptable. And then if you accept it, then they want more information before they pay. And then even if they do pay, they're going to want to try to return it afterwards. Like, there's so much that goes into being, you know, not dealing with a professional seller that is going to eat up a lot of your time, which if you can afford these things.
And guys, again, out in the world wide web listening to this, if you've ever wondered why I sold my 10 JLCs, like $90,000 wholesale value, to the company instead of selling them solo, this is the reason.
Yeah.
10 times 50 tire kickers is more time than I have.
Right. And that's the truth. So, I mean, one thing that a lot of maybe people don't see on this side is that, you know, we get 1,000 inquiries a day, right? But we don't sell 1,000 watches a day. So, you know, as salespeople, I'm going through the entire process, sales process, with many people who are not even really interested in buying, but, you know, we have to treat them with respect and give them a chance to buy the watch. So that's something you have to understand that you're going to be responsible for all that. And again, if your time is worth X amount of dollars, and then if you include that in the sale price, then maybe there's not that big of a delta between selling it to somebody who's then going to resell it for a profit, or selling it to somebody on the, you know, yeah, at full price, full market price.
Now, back to Josh the collector, which is our market tangent. You have had a couple of different Grail watches over the years. I've heard you talk about, originally it was the 5711 and the Watch You Want days. That was your Grail watch. Then you moved on to Audemars Piguet, and you were really good with that brand. They were your boys. And then also, I think last I heard from you, it was the F.P. Journe Chronomet Souverain, the CS. Tell me about the evolution of like your Grail watches. And let me ask, have you ever bought any watches from those brands?
So I own an Audemars. That is, this is, didn't know if it was a Grail watch. I didn't know it was a Grail watch at the time. It's a watch that I bought that I got like a halfway decent deal on it. It's definitely gone up since I bought it, so it's even better of a deal.
For the folks out in the World Wide Web, what is the watch you have right here?
So it's the full titanium offshore, 42 millimeter offshore. It's a 26170Ti. So it's titanium case, full titanium bracelet, chronograph. This is a 2014, so it's prior to the open case back models with I guess the full in-house movement rate is what they have now.
You know, the thing is, for years they used the in-house movement, or at least the in-house base, and they were solid case backs. And then, yeah, after 2014, you got the opportunity to see that for which you've paid with an offshore.
Right.
So the key thing about this watch to me is, there are two things actually going on. One, all grayscale, ranging from silver to black. Two, really unusual full bracelet. I mean, this is not something you commonly see with offshores. It was designed as a strap watch. This is almost like you're to use, I guess, a term of art, rounding off the octagon and blurring the line between the Genta version and the Emmanuel Get Offshore 92. This watch looks like a fusion of the two because it's on a bracelet. And that's a beastly bracelet to finish because the whole thing is grade 5 titanium. Did you buy it because of the bracelet, or did you learn to live with the bracelet, or did you learn to love the bracelet?
So I bought it. It was offered to me. So I bought a Panerai from a guy on eBay. And a year later, he messaged me saying, hey, I'm about to list this watch on eBay as well. But since, you know, we had a great transaction, you know, would you be interested in buying this? So we did a little bit of negotiating, and I ended up getting a deal that I thought was like slightly below market from a guy who I was comfortable with. So there's no question. Like, I wired him before he shipped the watch, which probably wouldn't do for anyone else. But It was an easy transaction in that sense. So I got the watch thinking, I'm like, all right, well, if I don't like it, I can easily get rid of it. I can sell it back. I can sell it to the watch you want. They'll buy it. Or I can find somebody who will take this watch off my hands for roughly what I paid for it. So that was the reason why I picked it up. And then when I got the watch, I realized that I've always liked the 42 offshore, but it felt a little top heavy. It felt a little chunky. One thing that I've realized about myself is I like watches that kind of look big, but don't feel big. Right. Yeah. That's, I guess, and I think that a lot of people feel that way. I mean, I see yours is kind of in that same.
And the sense. Wire, you've had wire lug Roddy mirrors in the past. Yes. That's another good example of that.
Well, even my Luminors, I've now I'm really only collecting manual wind panerized for that reason, because they sit a little slimmer on the wrist. So even though they look large, they don't feel large. So that was one of the things, the fact that this watch is in full titanium, it's not top heavy. It feels well balanced, especially on the bracelet. I have the rubber diver strap with the buckle, which I brought with me today too. But so I can swap it out, and it feels just as good. But that was one of the things. I'm like, all right, well, it's an AP, so it's from a brand that's highly desirable. So it's like I guess the fanciest watch I own. Like, if I'm gonna go out and I want people to know I'm wearing a nice watch, it's a great watch to have.
Josh is from Miami, for all you folks out in cyberspace. The fact that this isn't full rose gold is actually quite incredible.
Well, maybe that one day I'll have that. But to be honest with you, I don't think I would want to wear a full rose gold offshore on a bracelet, especially after wearing the titanium, because the fit, it's too bulky. Yes. Even though it's the same size, it feels way bigger.
There's a reason they call it the pounder.
Exactly. And honestly, the 42, the way that the case tapers into the bracelet and the way that it sits on my wrist, I love it. And it actually wears almost a little bit smaller than the 41 Royal Oak, which I've tried on many times. Just, I feel like the proportions work for me a little bit better. And again, the titanium is the key to all this. The fact that it's light on the wrist, I don't have to feel like I'm lugging around an anchor like you would do with the stainless steel version.
And I gotta agree with you, the standard, like 15400, 15500, 41 millimeter steel Royal Oak, that on a bracelet, it feels just as big as a 42 offshore.
Yeah.
And maybe bigger than a 42 offshore titanium.
Yes.
It's a big physical, I mean, it's a pizza box on your wrist.
Yeah.
And I could see this right here, it does not cover more area. It's thicker, but it does not cover more area than the standard auto. Mm-hmm. So another question, did you ever lived out any of those dreams, either in passing even, with a Jorn or a Patek?
So I've never owned a Patek personally. I've never owned a Jorn. So the closest I came to owning a Jorn was actually, you were involved. If you remember, when we went to go visit the factory, at that time I was wearing the only Jorn that I thought I could afford. And I say thought because, like, you know, it takes a while to get comfortable spending like a large amount of money on a watch. It took me a while. Now now it's crazy. But at the time, this was, 2017, right?
Yeah, 2017, October.
Right. Okay. So October 2017, we went to go visit Jorn in Geneve, and I was wearing a Elegant 48, which I thought was like the coolest watch. The full loom dial was amazing, because I was, at that time specifically, I was like, Panerai was the most expensive watch I had, but I have a thing for loom, which I love. So I love that. I love the idea of the watch. It looked cool, and it was like a very affordable watch from a brand that was seemingly unaffordable to me, which is kind of funny to say now as opposed to 2017.
Yeah, exactly. Well, the Jorn market has moved, folks.
Yes, it certainly has. I don't know if we had something to do with that. But so you're right. So I took that watch to wear to Switzerland, and my idea was that I'd wear it to Switzerland, when I come back, I'd buy the watch, and it would mean something to me. And it would be, at that time, probably maybe like I think it was like $7,000 or $8,000 I'd have to spend on it. Probably the most expensive watch I would have bought at that time. So I wore it to Geneva. We met Jorn. You remember as well as I do. Jorn's an interesting character. And I wore it and met him. And I let him know that I was wearing it. And his response was basically, he didn't give a shit. He didn't care at all that I was wearing that watch. In fact, I think he saw it and then like didn't want to make eye contact with me anymore.
He cared more about telling me how much he hated my JLC Duomet than he cared about complimenting your Elegant.
That is true. I tell that story to so many people that we sat across eating dinner, and I think you didn't stay for dessert because you decided you had nothing more to talk to.
I bailed.
That was a great time. But so that, I mean, I fully intended and had the funds ready and all that to buy that watch. When I came back, I was so disenfranchised by the fact that he didn't give me the warm and fuzzies, which, I mean, you know, this is my issue, not his.
Guys, if you wonder why F.P. Jorn has always been sort of like a polarizing figure, here you go right here.
Yeah.
He could be your best friend or he could blow you off sometimes in the same day.
Yeah, exactly. Well, yeah, we had a funny exchange later on, and I think that him and I kind of found common ground and bonded over it. But in the end, I realized that for him, it's mechanical watches that really matter. This watch, and if you know the story of how the Elegant 48 came about, it was kind of an afterthought. He made the male version as like as a special request to somebody whose wife had the female version.
Yes.
And you know, and while I'm sure, you know,
it was probably a his and hers type thing.
Exactly. But I mean, there was talk at one time either taking his name off the dial. I think what they were thinking about doing that. Then they decided not to. And they do very well with the watch. The watch is highly collectible. It was stupid for me not to buy the watch now that it's a $25,000 watch, not a, like a $7,000 watch.
The retail hasn't changed. That's what the market did.
That's right.
That's what the market did.
But people recognize, like I did at that time, it's like, this is the cheapest Jorn you can buy, and it's super cool. Like, regardless of his reaction when I was wearing that, and who knows what was going through his head, or if he was thinking about something else or whatever, but it was my perception that he didn't give a shit about it. The watch itself is amazing. The mechanism, the gold movement, the shape of the watch, the fit, is a great watch, and I should have bought it. But that's as close as I, to sum it up, that's as close as it came for me buying a Jorn so far. And probably, at this point, I mean, the price points are so kind of wild that it's tough for me to justify
it. It's parking a lot of money, even if you could get out of it for the same cash. It's just parking a lot of money.
Yeah, it is. And I think that my, in collecting in terms of grails, because you've asked me, that's kind of the genesis of this question. My grails have changed over time. And a lot of it has to do with value. There has to be some perceived value. I have to feel like I'm getting more than what I'm paying for in order to buy a watch. That's not the same for everybody, but just for me, I feel like I have to. So like my Panerai, my 233, I think I'm into that watch for like $6,000 or $7,000, and I wear it and I feel like it's a $12,000 retail. Yeah. It feels like a $12,000 watch. My AP, you know, I bought it at that time in the mid teens. They're selling for the low 20s, but it feels like a $25,000 watch to me.
So it looks like it too.
I appreciate that. And I think like that's one of the reasons why I may never ever sell it for that reason is that, you know, there's so much there. I feel like it's perceived value. So really my grail now, the 5711 is no longer a value at its market price. Not even close.
Right.
When I told you, when we talked about this back in Hollywood,
I think it was 2014, 2015 folks.
It was probably trading at like $25,000 or so, which was like, within striking distance of my budget, you know, if I sold a bunch of stuff and like got the courage to spend the money.
I remember a time when we would buy those in the teens.
Yeah, like 18.
Yeah. These days you can't, I mean, if you look at the Vacheron Overseas Automatic retails for $29,900 and it sells used for about $20,900.
That watch became a value.
That time, times changed, but that watch is still a good value.
Well, that watch wasn't a good value when it was released. In fact, you and I trashed it when it first came out, saying that it was overpriced and over-engineered. And now it's not the case at all.
Now, I wasn't necessarily down with being over-engineered. What I saw was a problem because the guys who were buying the Overseas before 2016, they saw it as a watch that you could almost always purchase with a discount.
Mm-hmm.
So if the chronograph cost, like, let's say $22,000 in steel, full bracelet, people expected to be paying like $17,000, $18,000 for that watch.
Yeah.
When they then decided that the chronograph Generation 3 would be a $29,000 watch and no discounts out of the gate, it's not just that the watch became too expensive. It's that they priced out the guy who previously would have considered an Overseas.
Yep.
And the guy who wouldn't have considered an Overseas before wasn't going to be convinced.
Not even thinking.
So for a watch, plus, let's be honest, there was like a weird watch industry exclusive recession from 2015 to like 2017.
Yeah.
Like in 2017, we started to come out of it. But I don't know if it was just the fallout from like the sovereign debt crisis in Southern Europe or what, but the watch industry, the news side of things did really bad from like 2015, early 2017. And Vacheron launched the Overseas into that maelstrom. So it was just like the worst of all possible circumstances, but a great watch. I think the automatic Overseas right now, I never really warmed up to the dial of the chrono, but I think the automatic Overseas right now, if you buy it at $21,000, is a really awesome watch to own.
I mean, what are you comparing it to now, right? So like in the past, it was 5711, Overseas 41, or the Vacheron. The Vacheron at that point was the most expensive of the three. Now you can't get you can't get a 5711 blue for less than what, $90,000 right now. You can't get.
Is it really that high?
Yeah. I mean, I know confirmed sales of 90. I see people asking over 100 for them now.
Wow.
But I know confirmed sales of around $90,000. So that's, there you go. So there's some, there's a dramatic spike in value once it was announced that it was discontinued. The Royal Oak now you can't really get for less than $30,000. It's over the list price, which you can buy them for, or you're going to wait years.
I've seen the jumbo, the 39mm jumbo, as high as 60.
Yes, so that for sure. The jumbo is wild, but just the regular 15500 now is over $30,000 in any dial configuration, and then so now for $20,000, the overseas is, especially with the different strap change and like the robust feeling, out of all three of those, that's the most robust watch. I would, if I was picking one watch to go like to, for my everyday and like to go in the pool and then go to dinner afterwards, just objectively, price not included, the overseas wins that battle. And now it's the most value. It's like the biggest value play out of all three. Whereas it used to be like throwing away money if you paid less for it.
Yeah, I mean, think about it right now. For $21,000, you're going to get yourself an overseas now. You can get silver, you can get black, you can get a blue dial. I would look for the brown, discontinued, but still my favorite. It feels the most substantial. Like when you're holding a 15500 in the hand, it feels great. But then you're thinking, okay, 50 meters water resistant. I can't get too wild with this watch. With the Nautilus, it's a lovely piece, the 5711. But you feel it in the hand and you're like, okay, it's 120 meters water resistant, but the bracelet's kind of delicate. The case is kind of delicate. The movement's not a sports watch movement. The overseas, you hold it in the hand and you're like, this thing feels, it feels like a Zen compared to the others. It just feels like a sports watch. Yeah, yeah,
exactly.
And you know, the other great thing is you're getting the quick release lugs. You're getting a bracelet that's fully sizable. It's got two quick adjusts inside of it. You're getting a strap in rubber. You're getting a strap in leather. You're getting a separate deployant clasp to go with those two. And it's just a wonderful product. But it's gotten to the point now where, you know, even those don't lose value anymore. I hope they don't go crazy. But if you're thinking of an overseas right now, guys, this is the time to buy. This is the time when you will look back, recall, and regret not moving on an overseas.
Well, that's when you know, like, the demand has increased dramatically in the watch world across the board when Richemont product is selling at or above list.
Yeah, they're very bad at managing that. This is the thing. Richemont owns many brands that I love. The problem is it's basically an investment bank operating a group of watch companies. So there's always going to be a mismatch between the goals of Richemont writ large and the individual brands, which like JLC, IWC, Panerai, Vacheron, Lange. These are great brands. Anyone would love to own these brands. You just wish that the brands themselves made all the decisions.
Right.
So for Vacheron to now be selling a watch in steel at list price, sometimes with a wait list, that's a real achievement for that particular group.
It's great. It's good. And it's good for the buyers of the watch too. Anybody who bought the watch in the past, now it's, you know, there's value there. But you know, even buying it now at list price, like, it's in the past, if somebody told me they went to a Vacheron boutique and bought a watch for full list at the boutique, I'm like, oh, well, you probably don't want to sell that watch because you're going to take a massive hit. It's not the case with these watches.
Now, speaking of Richemont, mm-hmm. you know, Richemont is decently well represented in your collection. You've got your M233 and you've got your Cartier. And tell me about this Cartier that you've got, because this is a great buy. Used or new, this is a great buy.
So this is the Cartier Santos large version now, right? Is it still the 100?
And the Santos 100 was new from 2004. This came out in 2018, mm-hmm. and you can always tell the difference because this has quick switch and smart link, and you're going to tell me all about it.
And it's a thinner watch. So this is just the Cartier Santos large, the current model. So I bought this, I want to say, I think it was 2018 or so. This was released in 2018, right?
Yes.
So I bought it the year it was released. I really liked it. Something about Cartier, I always felt like people who kind of like watch snobs didn't like Cartier. And there was a period in their time where they had like QC issues and whatnot. But I've always liked their design. It always seemed like a cool luxury brand. So like I could wear that watch similar to how I feel about APs. Like if I'm wearing my Cartier, it's like, I don't have to wear a Rolex to be flashy, but I can wear a Cartier. Some people might know what it is, and it's a nice watch and people like it, right? Including myself.
And the Cartier Santos Large, for folks following us, it's about $7,000 in steel full bracelet.
68, I think, is the retail. So with tax, about $7,000. And I bought this watch pre-owned right when it came out for like $4,000, right? It just, they didn't trade well. In 2018, Cartier wasn't trading well. But since then, with the rise of social media, which I've talked about many, many times, and people get annoyed with me repeating myself, but social media has brought so many, including like Instagram specifically, has brought so many people who otherwise wouldn't know anything about watches or wouldn't feel comfortable buying watches to understand watches, right? So you see like rappers wearing Patek's and things like that.
I would not necessarily say understand. I would use the word awareness. I think there's an awareness.
That's what it is, awareness.
If everyone understood the collector fraternity, I think social media would be a kinder, gentler place in the watch world.
Understood. So there you go. That's a much better way to put it. They're aware of these watches and understanding like what's what, which brands are real brands and not Invicta style things. So the Cartier, the skeleton, started being kind of worn by like athletes and whatnot and seen in social media posts and in magazines. So that changed the profile for Cartier from like guys who like maybe own one nice watch, like guys who used to buy Cartier in the 80s might own like a Roadster now or something like that, whereas now it's young people who are buying these watches and then they're realizing how comfortable they are. So it's a 39.8, I think, millimeter is what this watch is. It wears more like kind of like a 41 to 42 because it's a big square watch, but it's not as thick as the old Santos's, which were kind of unwearable, basically like panerized. The watch feels like butter on the wrist. It looks like a sport watch, but unfortunately, even though it has 100 meter water resistance, it doesn't have a screw down crown, so I never wear it in the water.
I mean, you're probably good to go in that regard as long as the watch is serviced routinely, but in the industry, we've seen enough watches without screw down crowns destroyed despite 100 or 150 meter water ratings. I would feel okay if the watch is new from the factory and under warranty, but again, we've seen disasters, and Josh has got screw down crown watches plus the Panerai here.
Exactly.
So he's got options.
Right.
I will say this. I love the way Cartier put together the bracelet system on this watch. It looks great. It feels great. It's very solid. You would never imagine that this is a bracelet you can take off the case with nothing but your fingernail and then size down. You can remove links without tools.
Mm-hmm.
Guys, Quick Switch and Smart Link. You got to check out the Cartier Santos large in steel. It comes with another strap. It's got the smartest bracelet in the business. This bracelet alone probably cost more to develop than like any given Grubel 4C. And I really sincerely mean that. The money that Richemont has sometimes goes to exceptionally good use. Yeah. And Cartier is an example of that here.
Yeah, they did a great job with this watch. But so this shows like from a collector standpoint, like I'm all over the place, right? I'm going to buy a lot of steel sport watches that I'm going to be able to wear in the pool. But because, I get to see so many watches. So like I'll have a Speedmaster, which obviously I'm not going to wear in the pool. Or I'll have the Cartier, or I'll have some vintage pieces. So I have some cool like vintage Hoyers and vintage Breitlings that I pick up like on eBay and or even like unsigned, like, are you familiar with Comsubin? The Italian Navy watches, like, or the Italian Navy.
I'm familiar in the sense that I'm familiar with Nebbi or U-Boat brands that I've never personally owned, but sure. I know they exist.
Right. Okay. So, and I've had U-Boat. I've never owned a U-Boat.
And Nebbi's kind of cool just because who was behind it. Yeah. U-Boat, I was never into.
A Nebbi and Anonimo or watches. I like, so.
Early Anonimo.
Early Anonimo. I have a 2000, a year 2000 Anonimo High Dive, it's outside the current ownership. Are they still in business?
They're still around, but it's not the same like refugee, like influx from Panerai,
right?
Like from Panerai Sistemi.
Yeah. So I have some cool watches like that. I have an eclectic collection for sure. But the Cartier is one that right now they're trading for like $8,000, right? Pre-owned. And I paid $4,000. So, I've doubled my money on it essentially if I can get full market value. But every time I go to look at this watch to say, hey, maybe I'll trade for something, I realize like it fits. It's the only true like dress watch that I have. And like I'm not gonna replace it with a dress watch. I have a lot of value and I like wearing the watch. So I don't think I'll ever sell it for those reasons.
Okay, so looking towards the future, you're definitely a more accomplished collector than you were before. You've made some mistakes, but you've corrected the record.
Mm-hmm.
What is your grail now? Do you feel like you have clarity of vision to really know what it is without, or have you experienced your grail?
Well, I've definitely experienced. I get to experience so many watches, so I'm lucky with that. So, but my today's grail, let me put it that way, is the 403035 reference Longa datagraph. So platinum black dial 39 millimeter original Datagraph. I think that's a watch that I will own eventually. They're starting to slide up in price. Hopefully they don't ever go crazy out of my price range. But that's, I think that is, because it's, okay, so it's a chronograph, right? Which is a sport complication. And it's made by Longa, which is like one of the finest watchmakers that exist, right? With the highest standards.
Philippe Dufour bought one of that generation. His is rose gold. That's the only difference.
The Dufour graph, right? Same watch. I like the platinum with black dial.
You and me both. I'd prefer that one
too. Yeah. Well, and I know you like white metals. But so that would be, that's my current grail. And I've really liked that watch for a long time. And every time I see it, I always love it. It's similar to how I feel about my Panerai 233, is that every time I look at that watch, I really love the watch. So eventually that'll be the watch that, that'll probably be the most high-end watch I'll ever purchase, I assume, in terms of price point complication and original retail. And one of the main reasons is there's so much value, I think, with that watch, especially at its current market price.
Yeah, I think with Longa across the board, whether it's the Datagraph, the Longa One, the Zeitwerk, even the high complications with them, if you look at what you're going to pay for something like Patek Philippe, you know, 5204, a split second perpetual calendar, and then you look at something like the Longa, at, you know, 1815, split second perpetual calendar, you know, you're talking like half price for at least as much watch and possibly a better looking timepiece.
Yeah, I think so.
So yeah, Longa right now is hugely undervalued. And the only thing that's really jazzing the market up is the rare occasion when someone like a Philippe Dufour wears a specific model, or if a historic piece from the 90s comes up, or a steel piece comes up. And then finally, there's the Odysseus. Though I will say this, that tidal wave is beginning to ebb. You're starting to see them in dealers in stock, which means that the rush is ending.
Yeah, that watch came out as very, very popular. And I think it was because it was something so different from a brand like Longa. And yeah, you are starting to see those more available. The prices are starting to flatten. I don't know if they're coming down, but they're certainly starting to flatten.
I think whenever you see inventory, that's the first sign that a wave is beginning to break a little bit. Because initially, there was no inventory. Every Longa store had a wait list. There was talk of, you know, forcing the purchase of a precious metal dress watch to get the watch up front. Mm-hmm. And once you walk into a store and they have one waiting, you know for a fact, just by virtue of that simple state of affairs, that the market has changed.
Yeah, exactly. The demand is being satiated. I think that watch is always going to be a watch that's going to be strong. You know, maybe it'll sell 10 off at a dealer.
It'll be strong by Longa standards. I don't ever see it doing a Patek 5711.
No, we don't want it to, honestly. I think that the craze on some of these watches, so people talk about a bubble, right? And we've been talking about these for years, and I've been wrong so many times. So I stopped looking at it as a bubble now. I think there are some bubble references, and there's going to be watches that once they get discontinued, there's going to be a bubble within that reference where the prices will shoot up and they'll come back down again. But in terms of things just in general being overpriced, I think there's just, we've talked about it now three times during this podcast, is that there are so many more buyers interested and willing to spend money on these types of watches than there ever was before. And that's, these people, even if like the economy tanks, world economy tanks or something like that happens, people aren't going to forget these exist, right? They've been exposed to them. Now they know which, you know, because in the past, I feel like the Swiss watch world wasn't so friendly, you know, like, there wasn't a great place to go figure out what watches I should be looking at, right? And there was a lot of like imposter style types of watches too. So like people making like knockoff style subs or knockoff style Pateks or whatever it may be. And you just, and if you're from an outsider, you don't have anybody to guide you. There was no way to figure it out. But now Tim Maso's on YouTube. So if you want to find out what watch you should buy, as a beginner, now you might not make those massive mistakes in spending, say like full retail on a lease known end, where, you know, maybe you should be able to buy it, pre-owned at a great deal or something along those lines. And those are things that I think people would get caught in those traps and then never come back and buy again.
So to put a cap on everything we've said today, and it's been a wonderful journey to revisit, like, because I remember these days, and I was with you in 2014 and 15 and 16 down in Florida. Uh-huh. If you have one piece of advice for the collector just getting started, looking back on the Josh Thanos who bought a Stoa, who bought a 7 Friday, who tested the waters with, you know, with Panerai early on, what advice would you give to guys just starting?
So my advice would be not to chase the hottest watches out the gate.
You know, if after you become comfortable with buying watches, you can go after, you can chase a Daytona or something like that, right? But, you know, don't chase what everybody else is chasing. Try to find a watch that's going to be nice and easy and reasonable for you. Start, you know, I always say like start under $5,000, but just start with something that's comfortable in terms of your spending. Like, don't buy a watch thinking that I'm going to have to trade this in order to get the next one or something. Try to buy something that you're going to like, but also do your research and make sure you're paying kind of market price as opposed to, you know, overprice. Right?
Yeah. Learn about the watch, but then also learn about its market. I think that's a great way to look at both sides of the coin. Josh, thank you so much. Folks, thank you for joining us. This has been the 8th Tim Maso podcast. There will be a 9th. Josh Thanos will return.
Time out, Tim out, Josh out. And thanks for logging on.